Well, friends, welcome to a new season of the Right Side Up Power Shift Edition. Jenna, please tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are and what you're doing right now.
I would love to. So I started out in the world in public policy. Interestingly, I have my first graduate degree and my life was working on Capitol Hill, which gives me an interesting perspective on the topic we're going to discuss today and how it applies not only inside of us, but also outside of us as well. And later in life, I became a therapist and started a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I encountered a model of therapy called internal family systems, and it changed everything for me. It changed my personal life, my spiritual journey, and the entire way that I do clinical work, because wow, it teaches us to do the opposite of what we've ever been taught to do. And as a result, it is enormously effective in helping us to heal. And it is exactly the same way that Jesus came and taught us to do exactly the opposite of what the world and the culture was teaching, and as a result, turned everything on its head. Jesus came into the world to move toward the parts of the world and of others that were the least desirable, to move toward with love and curiosity and compassion. And what the world teaches us to do is what the Pharisees were doing, which is to move against. And we have the exact same dilemma in our culture today. Politically, emotionally, culturally, we move against as a way of trying to solve our problems. And as a result, we make our suffering worse. And the counterintuitive answer that IFS, or internal family systems therapy, teaches us is to move toward the parts of ourselves and the parts of others that are the hardest to love, to move toward them with curiosity and compassion. And that is how we heal. And it is a game changer. It is utterly revolutionary and so filled with grace and compassion and the experience that our faith has always promised, but that at least in my own personal experience, in my faith communities and my faith journey, I had only occasionally actually felt. And wow, what an amazing thing coming from a really a secular model of therapy.
Yeah, I remember when you first explained this to me and you were just like, this makes total sense. Like, Jesus taught us this. Now, the system was designed by someone who's not a Christian. Yeah. But as you took the training, you were like, whoa, what he's naming, what he's describing without sort of Christianese is exactly how Jesus taught us to live. And I was, you know, I've been quoting ever since you told me about this system and I've looked into it. I've read your book altogether. You have some videos explaining more, but I'm going to get you to explain a bit more for our listeners. But I this made total sense to me. This new book I'm writing called The Other Side of Hope talks about sort of flipping over cynicism and despair and kind of looking at the other side. And even just those words that you use, like looking at ourselves with curiosity and compassion. I mean, what? Instead of shame and judgment and fear and self-loathing. I mean, I'm just like, So this is so powerful. And one of the things I say is like, of course we can't have hope for anything or anyone if we don't actually have hope in and with ourselves. And that idea of changing our posture internally can shift power inside of us, but also can shift the power outside of us too. So I love that connection you made with, like, you went from Capitol Hill, which is like center of power in an external, you know, national base, to this internal, wait a minute, the problem isn't outside of us, it's inside of us. And now making this beautiful connection that what happens inside of us actually can then flow through us. And we could have true, you know, peace and true reconciliation and true welcome, you know, even to our enemies if we were more curious and compassionate. So walk us through. So this is, I think this is like one of the most mind-blowing. I've told everybody about it. I mean, I really want people to capture this. I remember you telling me about just even as a therapist, being frustrated with the old systems, like just being, this is not working. And really it's not working. I mean, people are trying and I'm trying as a therapist, but like, I'm not seeing any tangible transforming sort of work. So the shift there, I think, is also because I think a lot of people have been stuck in sort of counseling systems that don't work. And so we're prone to be like, okay, that doesn't work. Yes. But this is actually like, oh, wait a minute, this is working. Right. So explain that, a little bit of your hopeful optimism about the future of counseling and therapy and how this might play a role, and then explain exactly what it is so that we understand.
I'd love to. So in our therapeutic communities, and to be honest, when we think about it, in some of our faith communities, and certainly in our larger culture as a whole, our strategy for dealing with the parts of ourselves and the parts of others that we don't like is to move against them. Mm-hmm. We are at war with one another, and it doesn't take much watching of headlines to observe. Even now on the global scale, my country is in a position of being engaged in potentially a global conflict. When we don't like other, we move against. And that manifests in things as violent as war outside of ourselves, or as intimate as war inside of ourselves. And what we realize in the clinical community, when we look through this beautiful lens of self-compassion, is that our suffering comes from parts of us that are at war with one another. Mm-hmm. And the reason that much of our move against approach is ineffective is because we over-identify with just one part of ourselves. So if we're, let's say, if we have a part of us that is feeling depressed or anxious or afraid, we will say, I am depressed. I am fearful. I am anxious. If we have a part of us that is stuck acting out compulsively, we will say, I am an addict. So we have this monolithic view of ourselves, which is very basic, and it doesn't allow for a lot of nuance. And so when one part of us gets stuck feeling or doing unhelpful things, our typical response in the clinical world is to move against that part. And we say very helpful things like, stop it. let me give you 3 points for how you should stop it. You need to get sober. You need to, you know, stop feeling that anxiety. And let me tell you how to write this down and question that belief and see if it's actually valid, and don't feel that and don't do that. And we have this message of stop it, which is very much paralleled sometimes in our very well-intentioned, but a little bit perhaps aligned with a stop it message of faith communities, but we put a spiritual spin on it. So we will say things like repent and nail it to the cross and tape these scriptures on your mirror and say them over and over again. And then you won't feel that yucky thing that you're feeling, or then you'll stop doing that bad thing that you're doing, as if that was all of who we are. We just put a spiritual spin on it. And the reality is that what that does is it tends to cause us to feel shame and suffering, and to drive our struggles further underground where they grow and become more unmanageable, because now we have parts of us that are at war. One part of us is feeling the feeling or engaged in the behavior, and another part of us is trying to force that first part to stop it. And as a result, our parts go to war with each other and our suffering increases. And oh, by the way, we're completely ignoring what's driving the feeling or the behavior in the first place. So it's really very ineffective. And what we see clinically, I work a lot with addiction. Our relapse rates in addiction are extraordinarily high. And I think the reason is because move against, stop it, if that's all we do, makes it worse. So IFS helps us to understand that we are not monolithic entities. We are not just one lump person, but we're actually far more complex than that. And doesn't that make sense? Because we're created in the image of a triune God, one God with three parts, and he puts us in one body with many parts to reflect his Trinitarian nature. And wouldn't it make sense then that I am one person with many different parts, and that my suffering comes, as Paul says so beautifully, from my desires that are at war within me. I do the things I don't want to do, and I don't do the things I do want to do. And oh, what a wretched man am I. And the beauty is when we begin to understand that, we also begin to connect with these beautiful principles of IFS, that deep within us is a core God image, what I call the God image inside of us. In IFS, we call it our authentic self. And that language is a little bit challenging for Christians because we hear the word self and we think sin and flesh and bad. It's not self in that regard. It just means who you truly are, who I truly am, and who we each are is made in the image of God. That is a birthright. And because, and this is going to blow many people's minds, so stay with me. Because the essence of who we are is made in the image of God, by the very fact that it is the image of God, it cannot be bad. It cannot be tarnished. And it turns out that this core of who we are, this God image or authentic self, as IFS would describe it, is where our authentic connection to the divine resides. And it is also where our healing resides. It is the image of God within us. We also have many different parts. And our parts are, when they are unburdened, as they were before the fall, they just make up our unique personalities. They're just who we are. We all have different parts. My son is a car enthusiast. The boy can hear an engine a mile away and can tell me exactly what kind of car it is and what kind of motor it has and all the different trim packages. And I don't really have that part. I think a car should take you from point A to point B with the best gas mileage and the highest safety ratings possible. Thank you very much. So that's just one of his parts that I don't share. It makes up our unique personalities. But when our parts encounter pain in the world, and when the world is not as it should be, we call that in Christianity sin. In clinical work, I call it trauma. Mm-hmm. And when trauma happens, when bad stuff happens, our parts become burdened. They carry the burden of, in Christendom, we call it sin. In clinical language, we call it trauma. And it obscures the beautiful nature of who they are. They become trapped underneath that trauma burden. Mm-hmm. And now, for example, let's say I have a young, playful part that is spontaneous and creative and loves to play and be silly. And I experience, let's say, a shaming, perfectionistic parent. My young, playful, spontaneous, messy part may become covered over with the burden of shame. But I am bad because I'm spontaneous and messy and playful. And now, instead of being able to access my playfulness, that part of me gets triggered and I get flooded with shame. And that doesn't change with time. Time does not heal those burdens. Trauma work heals those burdens. And so IFS helps us to understand that we have this core self, this God image, and many different parts. We have parts that we call exiles that carry our negative experiences. They carry our shame, our pain, all of our trauma messages, all of those difficult feelings. And then we get protector parts who become burdened in response to try to keep that pain away. Mm-hmm. They're trying to protect us from feeling that pain. We have proactive protectors and reactive protectors. So the proactive guys are parts of us that are trying to keep those exile feelings locked in the basement. And those are things like people pleasing, perfectionism, control, denial, and spiritualizing. Spiritualizing protectors are parts of us that use God language and do God things to try to pray away or make those bad feelings go away. Of course, this is ineffective. It winds up making it worse in the long run, but they're trying very hard to help. They're well-intentioned. Then we have the reactive protectors, and these guys are trying so hard to make the pain go away when it gets triggered. They are reactive. They jump in after the fact. So those would be things like all the things that come into my office. That would be addiction, self-harm, suicidality, homicidality, dissociation. all of the types of behavior that really our culture, our loved ones, most parts of ourselves move against, but they're really positively intentioned. They're trying to help us not feel the pain. And so what IFS helps us to understand is all these parts of ourselves are very much positive. They were created to do something good, but because they've been covered over by a burden of sin or trauma, they've gotten stuck in some unhelpful roles. So the solution is not to get mad at them and move against them. The solution is to give them access to the God image inside of us that will move toward them with compassion and curiosity and help them to unburden or release those unhelpful feelings and behaviors so that they can be freed up to be what God designed them to be inside of us. It is healing from the inside out. And when that happens, we are able to overflow that kind of love and curiosity and compassion onto everyone around us. And it is utterly transformational.
I feel like just even understanding a little bit, and I know this is just like this is a quick primer, and everybody who's listening, go deeper. I mean, but I feel like just even as you're explaining and naming this process that's happening internally, I can see Jesus at work. Like I can see literally what he's doing as he unburdens people and doesn't associate those people, does not, like, you know, the blind man on the side of the road and the disciple saying, whose fault is it? And Jesus is like, this is not about fault. Like, and this idea that like we spend so much of our time blaming and shaming, and like you explained, behavior modification has become sort of like the counseling that doesn't work, right? Where we just keep trying to lop off the branch and never really get to the root where the tree grows, right? And the root are these like self-belief, this who we are, the core of the essence of good. So this stuff is all just, you know, it's just so essential. I remember just like coming to this conclusion, just even in my own raising my own son, and we had this like little ritual at night where I would say, Moses, you know, who made you? And he would say, God made me. And I would say, how did he make you? And he would say, he made me good. And then I would be like, he sure did, honey. You know, he made you fearfully and wonderfully. He knit you together. You know, I remember one night I was doing that with my son, and I just literally was like overwhelmed with emotion. I shut the door and I realized that what I believed for him, I did not believe for me. And that was a fascinating, you know, again, this like uncovering, like, why am I not good? And I remember going into my room with my husband, explaining to him what was going on and saying like, when does Moses turn bad? You know? And then this uncovers like a whole lot of church doctrine, which is not old. It's actually fairly new, where we've totally overplayed this, like, you know, self as sin instead of self burdened with sin. And so I just love this idea, like Jesus and us are working together against sin. Sin is not our identity. Sacredness is our identity. And people are so like, this does trigger a lot of people. But Jenna, I explain a lot of this in my new, like, so just, I feel like there's like a theological shift, you know, where we're seeing things more clearly than we've ever seen them before. There's like a counseling shift going on. And then I think all of these internal shifts that are happening are about the possibility of us moving towards one another. And I really, you know, this is so, I was speaking to Sami Awad, who is a Palestinian peace activist, not long ago. And I was saying, tell me more about the conflict and like the hope for peace. And he just said, there will be no peace unless we deal with our collective trauma.
That's right.
Because he's like, we keep dealing with this behavior. And again, it's this again. It's just like, until we deal with these burden, it's not about the behaviors. It's about the root. And until we deal with that, there will be no peace. And I was just like, wow. And again, so you think of that like a Middle Eastern conflict that can never be solved until we actually get to the place where we can deal with this internal shift. I mean, now you were telling me you were worried at the beginning. So tell me about that. You were with a group of pastors. And you were a little worried because you're like, maybe some of these things make people uncomfortable. But I've experienced this as well. And this experience that you had, I've had too, is as we begin to speak this truth. And again, I think truth has power. And I think Jesus has times where he shifts people's understanding, where there's a revelation, like, you have heard that it was said, he used to say, but now I say, there's something shifting. So this is why I think this is so central. But you had this encounter with a group of pastors you were worried about, and then you were surprised. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, I completely agree. I think if we look back throughout the course of human history, the Lord has consistently had periods of time where the message of love has become distorted in some way, because in our human parts, often our spiritualizer parts, we try to do it right and we get a little bit distorted in that. It's a burdened part that is trying to help us. And a messenger comes with a new message that says, no, neither do I condemn you. That my message is love. Let me make this simple. Jesus says, let me condense this whole honkin' NIV study Bible thing that you carry around to just one word, my loves, and that word is love. Mm-hmm. That's it. And this is how they're going to know that you're my people, mm-hmm. love. And so it's very simple and yet wildly counterintuitive. And what I find that is a struggle for most Christians encountering this idea for the first time is really twofold. The first is this concept that who you are and who I am is good. Mm-hmm. For many people who are Christians in today's culture, that concept is in direct opposition to what we have always been taught, which is who you are and who I am is bad. Mm. And what I would say is that we mirror this message in our clinical work. You are an addict. Mm-hmm. You are anxious. You are a sinner. You are bad. Who you are is bad. And you need to change who you are so you can be good. And it gets really messy theologically because we say one thing, which is it is by grace that you have been saved and not by works, so that no one can boast. And yet we really live out something very different, which is get your act together, clean yourself up, quit doing the bad things, right? Because you are bad if you are feeling or doing those bad things. So this message that you are bad is pervasive in our faith communities, sometimes in our theology, in our clinical work. You are bad. And if we begin to really drink in the possibility that who we are is good, that is a huge shift. That is a revolutionary shift. And what I would say from a clinical perspective is the message, I am bad, is a trauma message. Mm. When we are survivors of trauma, we develop parts of us that become burdened with the belief, I am bad. And so I would argue theologically that this belief that, as you say, is relatively new in the history of theology, that we are bad, bad to the bone, is a result of trauma. And it is a way that we are, as traumatized, a collective trauma survivors, we are trying to make God in the image of man. Because we have a burdened part that believes who I am is bad. Mm-hmm. God can't possibly love me or be near me, mm-hmm. because I'm such a bad person. I have to get over there, you know, scoop over across my pile of sin to get over closer to God so I can be in the shadow of his wings so that he can tolerate me. The reality is God's in here. Mm-hmm. Right inside you and in me. The God image is inside of us. And by the very nature of the fact that it is the image of God, it cannot be bad. Mm-hmm. How could it be? It's the nature of God. It's the God image. So that is the first thing that I think really, really people struggle with. And what I argue is it doesn't mean there's no such thing as original sin or fundamental depravity of man. It means that that is not held by our God image. Mm-hmm. It is held by our traumatized, our sin-burdened parts. Mm. And when those parts get triggered, they obscure the access to the God image within us. So,
but also, you know, there's so many faulty ideas of, you know, that original sin, total depravity stuff. I mean, it doesn't make any sense because God, like, you know, the first thing is our sin separates us from God. And you're just like, but that's clearly not true. God comes to sinful man. Like literally in Genesis, God's looking for them going, who told you you were naked? Like, why are you ashamed? Like, I mean, it's so fascinating how we've just allowed trauma, sin to, you know, to colonize our imaginations, right? Like just to, and even, so we can't even, so when the psalmist is like, where can I go from the Spirit of God? Like if I go down to hell, you know, there he is. If I go up to the heaven, there he is. You know, like seems like he's wherever I am. Yeah. And again, this is this like, oh, right, because he's in me. And Jesus even, you know, like, so I just think like, it's so fascinating that we don't join Jesus in being common, you know, collective fighters against sin and death. I mean, this is Jesus came to destroy sin and death, not us. Yes. Right. Like, so I just think this idea of like just partnering with Jesus in liberating us from sin and death is the gospel. I mean, this is the essence of the good news. It's what makes it so good, right? Not that God can't stand you, but that God so loves you that he wants to work with you to liberate yourself. I mean, wow. Anyway, it's baffling to me that we twisted the gospel to be bad news before it's good. Yeah. And I'm like, it's good news before it's bad news, before it's good news. So I always say sin is not the first word. Yes. It's not the final word. That's right. It's a middle word.
Yes.
So if we could write, if we put it in its rightful place. And again, it's not this like denial that like bad things aren't happening or that I'm doing causing harm in the world or, you know, that's undeniable, right? We just look around. We're like, yep, that's true.
Yep. Exactly.
But how we conquer that, how we, you know, fight against that is not by despising ourselves.
That's
exactly. Not working out.
And it really only makes our suffering worse when that's our belief. And I think it goes back to this kind of simple idea that if we view ourselves as a monolith, I am just one big blob of a person, then if there's any trauma, any sin living in me, then I am bad. Like that's just by definition, I must be bad. When we think more dynamically, more in a more, I would argue, sophisticated way, that I have a God image in many different parts. And when my parts become burdened with sin, they sometimes take me over and obscure the God image inside of me. Then what I can realize is who I am is not bad, and who the different parts of me are is not bad, but the sin, the trauma that my parts carry is the problem. And God hates sin because that sin distorts what he created our parts to be. And when our parts then take us over, we lose access to the God image inside of us. And I can maybe it's helpful to give a real life example, because I know when we're just talking through this conceptually, it can be a little confusing. And again, in my book, Altogether You, I dissect the theology of this in a fairly detailed way. So
that's beautiful. Yeah. Get it, everyone. It's really, it's really good.
Yeah. But for those who can see the video here, I'm traveling today. So I'm in a hotel room. I have not my normal props that I would use. So bear with me, but I'll describe it for people who can't see the video. I have a little like Mr. Scrubby happy face that is from the kitchen here in the hotel. And just imagine that this sweet smiling face is the God image inside of me. This is who I truly am. And this is by definition, love. This is where my true connection to the divine resides. And this is always filled with what Dick Schwartz, the developer of IFS, calls the 8C qualities. So those are things like calm, clear-mindedness, compassion, connection, curiosity, courage, these 8C qualities that spontaneously emerge when I'm in connection to my God image. But I have many different parts. And let's say that, let me see, what would be a helpful real life example? Let me just do my cookie example, because most of us can relate to my cookie eater part. So let's say that this little hand wash thing here is the young and playful, spontaneous part of me that's kind of messy and impulsive and fun and fairly young. And this part of me became burdened when I was young, because let's say I was in a high performing perfectionist environment, either spiritually or academically or in a family of origin. And I learned that being spontaneous, messy, and playful was bad. And this part became covered over with shame. Okay. If I haven't done my trauma healing work to unburden that part, it doesn't stop being covered with shame just because I'm now 51 instead of 5. It still is shame now, and I don't have access to my playfulness. Which is why, incidentally, many of us who are survivors of trauma struggle to be playful and carefree. Mm-hmm. It's not because it's not there. It's because it's covered under a burden. Well, it doesn't feel very good to get flooded with shame, because when that happens, that sin or trauma separates me from the God image inside of me. I lose access to it. And it, those who can't see the video, my shame part gets triggered and it covers over, kind of like the clouds cover the sun. Mm. It covers my access to the God image. It's still there, but I can't feel it. I'm no longer calm, clear-minded, curious. When I do something wrong and I'm flooded by this part that feels shame, I feel the feelings of this part, which is shame. I think the thoughts that this part thinks, which is, I'm such a failure. I'm so horrible. I'm never going to be able to do this. I'm no good. Nobody likes me. Now, I'm going to have different parts that don't want to feel that. So I may have a proactive part. I'm going to use my glasses case here. The proactive part, let's say, is a perfectionist part. It works really hard to run my life so that I don't ever make a mistake and have that shame part get triggered. So it's running my life, doing things perfectly until it doesn't. It makes a mistake on the report. It says something stupid on the podcast. And all of a sudden, my shame gets triggered and I'm now flooded with shame. Now I have a reactive part that jumps in and takes over. Now I really can't find my God image because I've got two parts in the way. And this, as you can see, is my cookie eating part. I've got a little pack of Nutter Butters here. And my cookie eating part jumps in because the sugar rush of the cookie eating part makes the shame feel better for a minute. Mm. And then, of course, it makes it feel worse because all of our burdened parts help for a minute and then they make it worse in the long run. So my perfectionism part, it helps for a little bit because I do things well and people like that. But when I make a mistake, I go in a pit of despair and people can't be real with me because it looks too perfect. The perfectionist part actually drives away real connection, which is what's going to help to heal the shame that this part of me is carrying. And of course, the eating the cookies, it helps for a minute, mm-hmm. and then it makes it worse because then my internal critic part comes up and yells at the cookie eating part. And now my shame is worse. And round this little dance goes with my parts trying to move against each other. And as a result, making it worse, but my God image has gotten lost in the mix. So rather than striving out of these burdened parts, the solution is moving toward from my God image. And the way that we do that, and I'd be happy to actually even guide your listeners through a little exercise if they'd like to try it on themselves.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah. Let's say that I've made a mistake in some way. And I'm flooded with this shame part of me. Now I'm feeling shame. My body carries it. Maybe it's in the pit of my stomach. I'm thinking shameful thoughts. I'm such a horrible person. I'm a loser. Nobody's ever going to want to be with me. So now, instead of having my parts take over, what I can do, and I've developed a condensation of the IFS model. I've synthesized it down into three words so that anybody can use it. So that when we're triggered, we can immediately get relief. The three words are notice, know, and need. So let me just walk you through that. And then if you'd like, I can lead the listeners through an exercise. So when I get flooded with shame, the first thing I can do is notice where that shame is coming up for me and notice it with an open heart, with loving kindness. I actually am going to welcome it because that's what Jesus does. He welcomes all parts of us, inside of us and outside of us. So I'll notice, wow, I have a pit in my stomach. I'm noticing these self-defeating thoughts in my head and I just want to cave in on myself. Let me just welcome this part of me. It's not who I am. This is a part of me that's taking me over in a minute because it's triggered. Let me welcome those feelings, those thoughts, that sick feeling in my stomach. Let me just send some love to it. Okay, that's the notice part. Now I'm going to invite this part to separate just a little bit so I can get some access to the God image inside of me. And when this part of me feels respected and loved and welcomed, it calms down. It actually gives me that space. And now I'm feeling very compassionate toward the shame part of me, the part that carries the shame. And now from my God image, I can just ask this part of me, what do you want me to know about why you just took me over in that moment? Where did you first learn to feel that shame when you don't do things perfectly? What are you afraid might happen? So I'm just developing a relationship between my God image, who I really am, and the part of me that carries the burden of shame. And what we find, and this is another place that Christians tend to think is a little woo-woo. They're like, what do you mean we're like talking to parts of ourselves and hearing voices? No, you don't hear voices. But you'll get some memories come up when we ask a part of ourselves, where did you first learn to feel shame when you didn't do it perfectly? Suddenly we'll notice that some memories are going to kick up. Oh, when I was 5 years old and I made that mistake and my Sunday school teacher yelled at me, or when mom and dad were fighting and screaming and I was afraid that I wasn't a good enough kid. I couldn't hold their marriage together. And sure enough, they divorced. And so we'll get those memories. And then we can just move on to step three, which is need, where our God image can literally take care of the needs of the different parts of us. So the God image can really ask this part, what do you need from me to feel a little bit more comforted and a little less triggered right now? And sometimes that need is just an internal experience in our mind's eye. Maybe this part that feels shame is so used to being hated internally that it just needs a hug. This is that beautiful scripture, let the little ones come unto me and don't forbid them. And Jesus says, hey, don't kick this one out in the dark. Let this little shame part come to me and I just want to love on it. Maybe it needs something outside of us. And there's a way that when we use this therapy, we can actually allow the God image to unburden this part so it no longer carries the shame. So we've gone to the driving root cause of the overeating and the perfectionism, and we've healed it so that these parts no longer have to do that job either. We've actually gone to the source to heal it, and we've done it through the power of God. And this is pretty profound because we have no experience typically in welcoming the feelings and the behaviors and the beliefs that are painful. We don't do that. We move against them. We try to get rid of the shame and not feel it. We try to stop being a perfectionist or quit overeating. The entire diet industry is in place because we want to move against the parts of ourselves that are trying to help us cope with pain by overeating or binge eating or whatever it might be. We have no experience doing this, but the reality is this is what Jesus did when he came into the world. Mm-hmm. He did it outside, and we're now doing it inside of ourselves. He moved toward the lepers. He moved toward the prostitute. He moved toward the storm. He moved toward the cross with love. And that literally changed everything. And he said, now, as I've done, you go and do likewise. Mm-hmm. And what I've discovered is if we can't do that inside of ourselves, mm-hmm. with the parts of ourselves that are hurting and in pain, then anything that we try to do outside of ourselves to move toward anyone with love is going to be distorted. It will be coming from burdened parts of ourselves that are trying to perform or please or spiritualize, not coming from the overflow of the God image within us. And it is an entirely different way of approaching ourselves, because when we're flooded with shame or a desire to binge eat or drink or look at pornography or rage or whatever it might be, the last thing on the planet that most of us do is stop and notice and welcome that feeling, that impulse, with curiosity and get to know it and see how we can help it. It's simple, but not easy. Mm-hmm. It turns everything upside down and it gets to the source of where our suffering originates. And that source, of course, is sin. It's trauma, but not because we're bad. It's because parts of us have encountered pain in the world and they've gotten stuck mm-hmm. in some unhelpful roles. And we can help to transform that.
Wow. It's so good. I mean, talk about a shift.
Yeah.
Like, and a power shift, because this is at war with one another, even inside, at war with ourselves, is all about power and who's going to take it and who's going to hold it and who's going to, and then eventually maybe we get tired of fighting. And I'm praying we're all tired of fighting. I think we are, you know, just all tired of fighting. And it's time for some actual shalom, some wholeness, some peace. And out of wholeness, which is literally you're describing, like, how do you create peace within? And this is, thanks be to God. This is Romans 8. This is a solution that God has this wholeness in mind. And yeah, wow. It's so beautiful. Jenna, thanks for all that you're doing. Now, you said you had a way of an exercise that you could do for listeners that want to walk in this. And then guys, also, I just would like to direct you to more, just to discover more. So if this is like totally mind blowing for you and you're just like, what? This is a shift going on. I really think we're living in this beautiful time of God giving us revelation that shifts the way we think and the way we move in the world. And I think this is like a key to that, a really essential piece. So, and this also explains why people are moved when they hear this. You know, I think every time I share that, like, what, maybe that essential self, that original image of God within us is good first before any other thing happens. People are moved. It's so powerful because it's true, right? And we can feel it because there's a God image in us. We can feel it inside going, yes, like a witness of the Spirit going, yes, this is true. You are good. Why else would I, you know, come? But because I love you, you know, like, so it's just, anyway, fast. It's so beautiful. Yeah. So yeah, we would love you to lead us, and any next steps that you have for people where they can go next, would be helpful.
Oh, of course. I would love to. People are always welcome to come hang out with me on my website at movetoward.com. movetoward.com. I've got tons of free guided meditations and journaling worksheets and just different ways to help people apply this content. My book, Altogether You, is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. And if people would just like right this minute while they're listening to get access to this content in a really accessible way, they can just grab their cell phone and text my name, which is Jenna, J-E-N-N-A, to the number 55444. All you have to do is text Jenna, J-E-N-N-A, to 55444, and they will immediately receive free guided meditations, a journaling worksheet, so that if they want to try this out themselves in an area that they're struggling, they can implement this right away, and we'll just provide lots of free content. So those are some great ways to take a next step. And I really welcome people to check that out. But for now, for anyone who would like to really experience what this move toward is like, I would invite listeners, if they'd like to just maybe close their eyes or drop their gaze to facilitate turning their attention inward. Maybe taking one or two just slow, deep cleansing breaths. And let me invite you to call to mind a part of you that may be feeling or doing something painful that you would like to try moving toward. So this might be a part of you that gets triggered and takes you over with fear or shame or a sense of worthlessness or depression or anxiety. Or it might be a part of you that gets triggered and takes you over with behavior that you don't like raging or compulsive eating or drinking or looking at pornography. So once you have a sense of the part that you would like to get to know, taking just a moment to really take in the concept that this part is not who you are. Who you are is good. And this is a good part of you that's gotten stuck because of trauma or sin in a bad role. and we want to help it. So just invite that part of you to kind of come to the forefront of your inner awareness. And if that feels difficult, go ahead and let your mind drift back to the last time you can remember this part of you being triggered and taking you over. When you felt the feelings of this part of you and wanted to behave in the way this part of you behaves. Once you've done that, you're ready to take the three steps of move toward. So to begin, step one, just notice with loving kindness how this part of you shows up in your life. Notice that it may show up in your body somehow. Maybe tension in your neck or shoulders or jaw. Or a racing heart, or a pit in your stomach, or an impulse to do something. It may show up with some emotion or some thoughts that go through your mind. So recognizing that all of these manifestations are just coming from this part of you, see if you can welcome this part of you with open-hearted curiosity and loving kindness without trying to shift it or change it or judge it in any way, just letting it be present, welcoming it. And it's okay and perfectly normal if that's difficult at first, because it's natural to not like negative feelings or behaviors. So just staying with it, noticing we're not saying what it's feeling or doing is okay. We're just welcoming this part. And then as you begin to gain some open-heartedness toward this part of you, you might even begin to get an image of it pop into your mind's eye. And feel free to ask this part of you, what do you want me to know about you? You might want to ask this part, why did you take me over? What caused you to get triggered in that moment? You might ask this part of you, where did you first learn how to feel this way or do this thing in my life? And just notice if some early memories start to pop into your mind. And if some earlier memories did come to mind, just perhaps sending some compassion to this part of you, that was the point in your life when this part probably became burdened and lost access to what it was really created to be inside of you. And now you're ready to move to step three, which is need. You can just ask this part of you, what do you need from me right now to feel a little more comforted, a little less activated? And just notice if anything comes to mind. Don't try to figure it out. Just ask, what do you need from me to feel a little better right now? And you may notice that you get a sense that this part would just love a hug or to be comforted in your mind's eye in some way. I know that may seem a bit strange, but if that does come up, see if you can just provide that and notice how this part of you feels now as it's able to really literally run to the God image inside of you for an embrace. Or you may get a sense that this part of you needs you to take an action in your external world. It may need you to set a boundary or ask for help or connect to a safe friend so that it doesn't have to take you over quite so much. And if you get a sense of that, and that feels like something you can provide, set an intention with this part of you to do that. And notice how it feels now. And whenever that feels complete for you for today, just gently allowing this inner visualization to settle back into your mind's eye. And beginning to bring your attention back out into the room around you. And just reconnecting to your external environment. And so that's just a brief illustration of how we can use the three steps, notice, know, and need, to help our God image be in relationship to a part of us that is hurting and that's gotten triggered and taken us over. It's certainly not doing deep trauma work, but if people like this approach, that's what those of us who are IFS therapists are here to help with, because we can ultimately unburden those parts so that they no longer carry the shame, the fear, the addiction anymore. And it's
so beautiful.
Really beautiful. Yeah.
So beautiful. All my inner imaging was like the Jesus in me was like welcoming me, you know, like it's really beautiful. Thank you so much, Jenna, for your time and what you're up to in the world and for the shift that I think is so transformational. And I'm so excited to see the fruit as people discover this and begin entering into their own wholeness and callings and, you know, wow, how transformative it is. I think this is going to be more powerful than all the days you could have spent on Capitol Hill.
Well, I certainly hope so. And I'm so honored to talk with you today. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jenna. Bless you. I'm not sure that I've mentioned The Creative Way Down in some time, but The Creative Way Down is a 3-month deep dive, a course in depth. It uses the Beatitudes and it features Aaron White, who's one of my great, good, beloved friends, and also one of the wisest, and by wise, I don't just mean smart, although he's that, I mean also lived experience and lives out what it is that he knows, which is kind of the definition of wisdom. He instructs us in the Beatitudes as a way into a deeper way of participating with the life of Christ. And it is deep, beautiful. There's a really in-depth manual that has like early morning, midday, and evening exercises and prayers. There's playlists associated with it. There is a podcast where Aaron and I just discuss every single video, every single lesson. There's a lot. And so if you wanted something to do with some friends or even with one person, we do recommend doing it together with somebody where you want to say, you know what, I really want to focus in on surrender, or I really want to focus in on generosity, or I really want to focus in on mission or others. Those are the lenses the Beatitudes are in. And it is a robust, beautifully practical, deep way of entering into the creative way down. So go to infinitumlife.com and you'll see The Creative Way Down there, and check those out. Those are available for anybody at any time, and it is a phenomenal resource.